Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast by Bald Move. We're the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones, formerly on HBO, future on HBO. I'm your host, Aaron, and I've got a surprise podcast I'm dropping on you. When we signed off, we said there would be things here and there that we drop in on the feed and kind of touch base as new things are released. We're waiting for Fire and Blood Volume 2, waiting for Winds of Winter, waiting for the prequels, waiting for any sequels. But we've had a new piece of media drop. Our old friend Kim Renfro, which if you've listened to this podcast for several years, you know that she's been on a time or three on our podcast to talk about Game of Thrones. She's been writing for Insider since season 5, doing deep dives of the coverage over there. And she has an official guide to the Game of Thrones book that she has released. It just dropped this week. It's available on Amazon or bookstores everywhere, any of your local bookstores. You can get it on audiobook. We're very pleased to once again have the entertainment correspondent for Insider and now published author Kim Renfro on our show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So I've read a good deal of the book, and of course, I am fascinated by all things Game of Thrones. I'm also fascinated in kind of like the process of writing. I've written a couple books myself. I was wondering, just from a standpoint of that, like, how did this process start? Like, where were you just sitting in your living room and you thought, light bulb, I want to write a book? Was so were you approached? Is this something that kind of dovetailed from your experience with working at Insider or what?
Yeah, so it definitely was sort of spurred by my experience working at Insider. I know a few other reporters who had basically been able to turn their beat or whatever it was that they were covering into a book deal. So I was aware that that was a possibility, like that was an avenue I could go down if I felt like it. And then as you know, we got confirmation that the final season was coming, we were going to have this gap year. I just kind of realized like, all right, someone is going to write a book about this show if they haven't already started. And I just felt like I wanted to be that person. So I started talking to folks who I knew who had written books before and got some advice and pointed in a couple of good directions for like how to put together a book proposal. And then I found an agent with that book proposal who said that, you know, this seemed like a viable idea. So I signed with a literary agent and that was in January, 2018. I'm like, what year is it? It's been the longest,
yeah,
like 12 months of my life.
Relatable.
So I got an agent, I polished up the book deal and then, or the book proposal, and then he shopped it out to a bunch of different publishing houses. And we wound up with 3 offers on the book, which was really awesome. And I decided to go with Simon & Schuster.
What was the, reading this book, it seems like you had a great deal of material that kind of came from your reporting. You had this wealth of like interviews and articles that you had written and like all the stuff that you can kind of draw from. Did this feel like more like being the editor on an anthology where you're just kind of like tying all this stuff together? Or was there a lot of daunting original material that you had to write? Or kind of like was the writing process stressful or easy breezy? What was it like?
I definitely, out of like kind of laziness, was like, okay, what have I already written that I can use in this book? Because obviously I had a limited amount of time in which to get it done. But I definitely made my outline based on things I knew I could easily write about and lend my expertise to. But I also specifically built out chapters of things that I had never had the opportunity to write about for Insider for whatever reason, and really felt like digging into. You know, my book wound up being a little over 94,000 words, I think. And for me and my regular job, writing like a 2,000 word article for Insider about Game of Thrones was long. Like that was like about the longest I could go. Mm-hmm. So I was really excited about the idea of being able to extend what I was saying and be able to kind of tackle it with a slightly different voice, like have a little bit more fun with it than I would in my normal professional writing capacity online. So yeah, it was a mix of both. There's definitely some chapters in the book that are like were basically copied and pasted from articles I had written, but then just tweaked a little bit. But then I really wanted to explore other things, like the whole pilot episode, and sort of the earlier seasons and the pre Game of Thrones universe of Benioff and Weiss and Martin. I had never really written about in depth, so that was all new, and I got to do a lot of research for that, which was fun.
It kind of dovetails on one of the things, aside from just kind of meta discussion about the art of writing a book. That is the thing that surprised me the most, too, because like I, you know, was aware that there was a previous pilot, and I know that they did a lot of reshoots, and sharp-eyed people can see like, oh, this is the blonder Tyrion from the original pilot, and this is the super blonde Jaime from the earlier pilot. As you go through, there's a little bit that stuff survives in the existing pilot, but I did not know it was the apparent train wreck that it was. And like the whole first few chapters, because this is kind of sort of chronological and like, you know, the conception of Game of Thrones, the production of Game of Thrones, you know, the series itself, fan react, like there's kind of like this, you know, a broad chronological bent to the book. And the first few chapters about this inception, how did this thing get greenlit? Because you do this good job of laying out like what a disaster the pilot was, how relatively untested a talent the Double D's were individually and as a team, and you look at the sums of money involved, like $20 million for the pilot that had to be reshot 90%, $50 million budget total for the first season. Do you have any insight of like why this property, why this project, why this team the HBO took this big gamble on?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most interesting things to me that I hadn't known before and hadn't read before was what is called the show Bible. And that's this basically a pitch document that Benioff and Weiss had to write. And that was their pitch to HBO. That this was them laying out, here's exactly what this show is going to be about. Here's our vision for it. Here's why it's like shows that have been successful before, like Deadwood or HBO or Sopranos. And here's why it's not like Harry Potter. And it's not like, you know, I think they called it corny and kiddie fantasy. It was their sort of dig at existing franchises. And reading that, what struck me the most was just like this very brazen confidence that was like coming off the page. You know, they're swearing every other word and being like, people are going to lose their motherfucking minds. And like, and all of that coming from two men who had never like run a show before. They had never written for television before. They had never had a successful TV program. And I think that it's that, It was like this surprising level of confidence, but I'm also like, okay, like this is, I guess, how you get shit done in Hollywood, you know, like kind of rolling back to what I was saying about writing my proposal. It was very hard for me to put together a book proposal, and like, you kind of have to brag about yourself in it. You have to like say why I'm the person who's going to write this Game of Thrones book, and here's everything that I've accomplished, and here's like why people are going to buy the thing from me and not from anybody else.
This and motherfucker's going to fly off the goddamn shelves.
Yeah. And I struggled really hard with that. I have a lot of like creeping self-doubt, and, you know, imposter syndrome is the kind of catch-all term for it. And I think Benioff and Weiss, for whatever reason, if they have that, or if they had that at any point, it's definitely gone now. And it wasn't visible on that page. And I think that they just did a really good job of packaging this idea of, okay, we know Lord of the Rings was a success. Here's why this show is going to be a success for HBO. You know, Lord of the Rings didn't have any sex or like this sort of like dirty, like HBO style appeal to it. And I think they did a really good job of selling it. And then I think they got lucky with the people who were on the other end of that pitch. And those people just felt like taking a swing. They felt like it was time for HBO to come out of the gates with something new. You know, they didn't know it was going to be the success that it was. I think, again, Benioff and Weiss got lucky by being handed this roadmap by George R. Martin that was like some of the best fantasy writing we've ever seen in this entire country. Yeah, I think it was a combination of luck and just like brazen confidence that they sort of managed to, in so many words, like BS their way through the learning curve. And then once they got a handle on it, it was, you know, it was all uphill from there.
Which came first when they're writing that the show Bible? Did they have George Martin? Did they have George Martin on board before they went to pitch this to HBO, or they pitched it to HBO and then won Martin? Because I know they actually did win Martin over this famously long dinner that they had, where, you know, they essentially kind of like the seal of approval was put once they correctly deduced the actual identity of Jon Snow's parents. Do you know which came first on that?
They definitely had his blessing before they got started, I'm pretty sure, because they had to know that George was on board. And again, speaking of like more luck, it was kind of serendipitous that Benioff and Weiss were given the books by George's then agent, or he still is agent, Vince Gerardis, one of his agents, gave Benioff and Weiss the books, and they, you know, devoured them. And they privately decided that this should be an HBO show, that would be the best fit for it. And George had been pitched many times on it, on turning the books into movies or like a trilogy or something. And he was also privately thinking this should be an HBO show. That's the best fit for it. So it was definitely kind of serendipitous that they sat down for that meeting and they were both like, hey, we should make an HBO show. After that lunch, it was up to Benioff and Weiss to put together the pitch and write, you know, the pilot script and probably the entire season one outline, which is what's in that show Bible. And then, you know, they convinced HBO to give them $10 million and set up shop in Northern Ireland and film a pilot, which then went horribly, horribly wrong. Not like, okay, it definitely was a disaster, but it's like, it's clear that the folks at HBO saw something in that disaster that was workable. You know, if it was a wholesale, like, this is a pile of trash and this is going nowhere, they maybe would have just cut their losses. But I think we're lucky that the then guys in charge, Richard Plepler and Michael Lombardo, were able to see the potential in that. And I think that's a full credit to them, that they knew, okay, these guys didn't nail it on the first try, but this is a very compelling story and these are best-selling books. So like, let's just throw some more millions of dollars at them and hope that it works out.
Yeah, I know reading those chapters, it seems like the things that really impressed was the casting, you know, because very few changes were made. I know they had they substituted Jennifer Ellie for Michelle Farley as Lady Cat, and there's a few others and some minor changes to, like, you know, wigs and costuming, but like the production value was there and the main cast was there, and it seemed like that was like, if you squint, you're like, I can see this.
Yeah.
But it's funny because, like, listening to you tell this, I feel like all the seeds for its successful inception, like, you know, the let's say confidence of the showrunners and like maybe their inexperience with, like, you know, trying to do this and actually failing, that made it get off the ground, but it's also the thing that made it very hard to land in a universally successful way.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So I got a lot of other questions and stuff I want to talk about, but we're like, since we're kind of talking about the arc of Game of Thrones, what is your take on what happened? You know, this is like one of the A1 flagship shows of the Golden Age of television. It was met with kind of wide disapproval. If you look at the IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes rankings of the seasons, you get to like, you know, the final season and just things fall off a cliff. And I know it's got its defenders and its supporters, and probably some in this audience are amongst those cats. But like, you know, there's a lot of disapproval. There's so many interesting things, like the fact that they just wanted to stay to 13 episodes in the last two seasons. The fact that they, you know, HBO was like, hey, we'll pay for more if you want to, like, you know, give this thing room to breathe. They're like, nah. What happened? Like, was this good faith? This is all we need to tell the story. Was this them kind of like, being impatient with kind of writing George's fan fiction for them? Was it just them eager to get onto other projects? What's your read on this?
Yeah, I mean, fully from just like an outside close observation of them and the production over the years. I've unfortunately never been able to interview them, but I would love to someday. But I did just get the increasing sense that they were burned out. Like, if you watch, even, you know, those inside the episode things became kind of like their own running meme for the final season. But it's like, to me, I was watching two people talk about a show that they were just like tired of being so in the muck with, if that makes sense. Like,
right.
You know, they were on year 9, I think, total of living in a different country 80% of the year, working harder than probably most people work in this business. Like Game of Thrones, you know, there's like
pretty
the
grueling
cliche of like, oh, it's movie. Like it's, you know, it's a movie, but just 6 episodes or whatever. But it's like, it really was a scale of production that like no other television show has seen before. And again, they've never done this. It's not like they were seasoned television producers who went into a decade of like the hardest work of their lives. This was their first experience with this. So I just got the sense that sure, HBO would have given them as much time and money as they wanted, but I felt like they were ready to move on and be done with this and wrap it up. And everyone, like, you know, all of the cast kept kind of parroting that line of like, oh, well, like, we'd rather go out on a high note than like overstay our welcome and show fizzle out. Sure, that's true. But I don't think that they were in danger of doing that. I don't think that if we had two 10 episode seasons for 7 and 8, that people would have been like chastising them for milking the show. So I don't know. I get the sense that, yes, they were tired. Yes, they were ready to move on to something else. It's also like sure, they had this sort of unearned confidence in that pitch letter, but so much of that confidence was built off of reading George's incredible story.
Yeah.
And being like, hell yeah, we can, like, this is going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. They didn't sign up to write their own show. They did not sign up to finish George's story. And right. So however you feel about the job that they did with that, I don't think that you can fault the fact that they didn't think that that was going to be their job.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that's the where when I'm charitable to the double D's, I often come back to that. Like, as you talk about the insane quantity of work it takes to pull something like Game of Thrones off. Well, that's just an adaptation. And
right.
There's plenty of talent in, you know, an adapted screenplay. But then when you're just having to write an original screenplay and it's not your story, and there's like, you also, you know, if it was your story, maybe you wouldn't have made all the decisions that went down to I do think that it's,
yeah.
I don't know. It felt like there's a lot of frost in the relationship between the showrunners and Martin too. And I don't know if that's real, perceived, or, you know, maybe it's just business and it's unfortunate for everybody involved, but like that's how I felt as a fan looking out in from the outside.
Yeah. Where I fault them again from the outside looking in is that if they did feel like they were at this sort of like burnout point, or they were a little bit running low on like efforts to put in whatever, I wish that they had like expanded their writer's room or just mm-hmm. like doled out a little bit more to people like Brian Cogman, because there's a reason why A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms is like lauded as the best episode. And it's because Brian Cogman is the person credited on it. And he was always a writer who I think pretty consistently on the show was really, really dedicated to those like smaller character moments. And Benioff and Weiss really enjoyed tackling like the bigger mm-hmm. epic battle, whatever you want to call it.
And that was the whole last season, with the exception of Knight of the Seven Kingdoms. Yeah.
Right. And so my biggest lament is that like, I have a feeling that by the time they were hitting season 7 and 8 and they felt like, okay, we don't have George's material anymore. That was also like, they were hitting their peak of winning Emmys and they were getting nothing but praise for this show. So I feel like they felt like, okay, fine, we got this. And I kind of wish that they had just been like, just in case we don't got this, maybe let's ask for like some extra voices in the room to like help us land ship. But I think that by then, again, if their confidence was overblown before they even started making the show, I can't imagine how confident they felt in themselves during that, like, seasons. Like, the fact that season 5 was, like, a Emmy award-winning, like, record-breaking year for them, mm-hmm. and that, in my opinion, is the worst season.
Interesting.
I have my issues with season 8. I think as a whole, season 5 is worse.
See, I remember saying this in the podcast is like, I think like as recently as the end of season 7, I'm like, you know, Game of Thrones, great show. It's very exciting. I said, but if they don't stick the landing in season 8, I think there's going to be a lot of long knives coming out for season 6 and 7. Definitely. I think the big problems with season 5, I imagine, are like the Dornish subplot.
It's like, it's Dorne, but it's also just like, there's no balance to it. It's really, really bleak, like from start to finish with the, and like Hardhome is the pinnacle of that season. And it's one of my like top 5 episodes of the whole series. Mm-hmm. But even that, it's not like, that's not an epic, glorious fight. Like that's a massacre.
It's a beatdown.
That's really ominous. Mm-hmm. And there's just like, they completely abandoned what I think was always great about earlier seasons, was like this balance of there's some levity, there's some really nice pairings of characters and good character arcs, but it was just like that season was all about bringing each of our characters down to their lowest points mm-hmm. with no real optimism. Mm-hmm. And again, that was like, that was the first season after they had the sort of bullet points laid out for them by George. And so I'm just like, season 5 just continues to baffle me, because I'm like, just a lot of the narrative choices they made, like with Sansa stuff, all the Dorne stuff for sure, which fair. I think that was Dave Hill wrote some of those episodes, but Brian Cogman also did have a hand in some of those episodes. So, you know, nobody got out of season 5 looking great, in my opinion. I feel like it was a low point kind of across across the board in terms of the writing. And then after that, it's like, yeah, the people who were like really, really taken aback with season 8 and their dislike of it, it's totally fine, totally valid. For me, it was a little interesting watching the conversation because I was like, these problems have been there for seasons. You know?
I think people were willing, because I always had the analogy of like, you know, sometimes you find yourself off road and, you know, you can continue down this bumpy gravel path, but sometimes the good idea is just like shift it into low gear, drive through the mud, get back on the highway. And I felt like there was a lot of that in okay, well, they are going someplace. We don't know where they're going. And they were driving down this road that George, you know, had paved and then it turned to gravel. And then it turned. So like, they're trying to like, it's a pretty broken, rough ground, but they're going to make it. And when it turns out the destination was a landfill, like, okay, well now I'm questioning all the detours that we made now too. So it's where it's like, I kept on giving them rope and giving them rope because like they, it's just like you said, all the things that led to their success, that confidence, and you know, when they're kind of like, you're already saying, entering the trough of the Game of Thrones experience, and they're like, we're crushing it, bro, look at all the Emmys, and why would they hand the reins over, why would they exhaust, but you know, if you're exhausted and you're tired, you know, like HBO turns over showrunners, it's not unprecedented, like look how many showrunners fucking True Blood had, you know.
I mean, that was a great success story, but... Yeah, I would never have expected them to step back from showrunners. Again, I think it's that writer's room problem. Bring some frickin' women in every once in a while, fellas. Yeah. It's not going to kill you. But also, like, I think Brian Cogman... I feel like Brian Cogman understood what people wanted out of, like, a final episode. And Benioff and Weiss, for whatever reason, were very convinced that all people cared about was the
motherfucker blowing away the audience and blowing people's minds, and they just leaned into that. Yeah. It's unfortunate. I wonder what's your kind of gauge on how the fan base is, because you know, one thing about being on our podcast is, to a certain extent, after doing this for many, many years and the way we've covered the last few seasons, we've kind of self-selected, especially after we've covered season 8, we've kind of self-selected the fan base, because the fans that just love the show and don't want to hear anything about negative have moved on to other pastures. So maybe we're a little myopic, but I know you, we didn't get a chance to go because we were too busy to the Con of Thrones. You know, you're doing promotion for a book now. You've been a lot more plugged in the last few months since, you know, I've kind of like moved on to other things. What do you feel like, what does the fan base think about right now? What was the mood at Con of Thrones, et cetera?
Oh, Con of Thrones was a delight. That was like, I felt revived from Con of Thrones.
Did
it
feel
way.
Like a support group, or was people just like, you know what, we're just going to ignore the elephant in the room and talk about how awesome Game of Thrones was?
No, it was a mixed bag. I think it depended on what panel you were at. Some of the panels it felt like support group time, but I think more often than not it was like, let's celebrate this thing that we all love and that has obviously brought us all into this room together. But then it was like, there would just be the occasional like aside or like a joke about whatever. But for the most part, it was a really nice reminder to me of just how many great people I've met through this fandom and just how lovely everyone can be and supportive. And like, we all have this shared interest, and yeah, it was, Con of Thrones itself was really nice. And I think that speaks to the in-person interactions about Game of Thrones versus the internet and like online interactions about Game of Thrones. Because for me, season 8 is not a black or white thing. It's not a, I hate this or I love it. It's like a very complicated relationship that I have to the show and to how I feel about individual things that happened and choices that were made. And it's really hard to have that conversation in like a 140 character tweet or like a few Slack messages.
Sure.
Whereas if you're chatting with someone in real life, you can kind of like dig at the things that bothered you or didn't bother you a little bit more.
It's also tough because like, I think I've never seen anything like this where you know, if because a show, when you're grading it, it's like, okay, what does it look like? What does it sound like? Who is in it?
Yeah.
And what dialogue are they saying? And how well are they selling the dialogue they're saying? And, you know, what do you think of the plot? And, like, usually when something's a mixed bag, like, it's, you know, you've got, like, well, the casting is a 7 out of 10, but the dialogue's a 5 out of 10. And then the costuming's like, eh, you know, you can tell the budget. This is, like, the only show I can think of where, like, acting in season 8, 10 out of 10. Set design, 10 out of 10. Costuming, 10 out of 10. Stunt work, 10 out of 10. Cinematography, 10 out of 10. And then you get to score 10 out of 10. And then you get
the best thing you've ever heard, yeah.
Then you get to, like, plotting, and it's, like, 0 out of 10, 3 out of 10, 5 out of 10. Like, nobody's giving it 10 out of 10, I don't think. And I've never seen something that's, like, just... Like the plotting was their dump stat, to go back to, like, a D&D kind of analogy. And I think that's what really complicates people's feelings about it. Cause, like, I really love Game of Thrones production. There's hardly anybody to fault except for the two people on top and their decisions about the way they ran the writing room and what they thought was important to the fans.
Yeah. And it is, like you said, very unique. Like, this, it's also, like, just flat out, this adaptation overtaking its original source material has never happened on this scale before. Like, everything about Game of Thrones feels unprecedented and also, like, unrecreatable. Like, I don't think that we're ever going to have a show like this again that causes this kind of a fervor in its ending, just because we don't watch TV in the same way anymore. But yeah, so on, like, my sense of how people feel, especially online, is like there's definitely some burnout there, where, like, people, there was a few weeks, like maybe like a month after the finale, where, like, people still seemed really into, like, discussing their feelings, and most of those feelings were negative. And there was this kind of, like, you know, the memeification of, like, shitting on the show and all of, like, the free folk memes and stuff, and that was, like, that kind of, like, kept things going for a little bit. But even now, like, even that has died off. Like, people just seem to flat out not really want to talk about it as much. And, I mean, that's kind of bad for me as I'm trying to sell this book.
Hey, but... like I said, that was the thing that I felt like, is that it was hard to sell Game of Thrones enthusiasm in the final season of Game of Thrones. Cause, like, you know, I had a book of my own I was trying to move. So I feel you on that. Now, it's interesting, cause I was looking, the last significant piece of critical analysis I can think of at Game of Thrones is Lindsay Ellis's, like, epic two-part, like, Game of Thrones hot take. And it got 2 million views.
Yeah.
So, like, there's still some appetite for that, because I think there's, you know, it's kind of like a non-serious natural disaster or political crisis, where it's just fun to kind of theorize and speculate about, but there's very little stakes. And I don't know. Well, I want to talk about some more positive things at this point. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. There is so much behind the scenes, really interesting information that you have in the book. I really liked the chapter towards the end on the everyone getting their death phone calls.
Yeah.
Like how this is the way some of them talk about it. It's like you get the state troopers are calling you late at night and like there's been an accident, you know, and it's not that serious. But like a lot of these people, you know, it's. You get a call, and especially if you're not reading ahead in the books, because I know that was a choice a lot of the actors made. This is a huge career. And also, a lot of people died before they were supposed to die in the books.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking of like, Sir Barristan. It's like that probably came to a shock to poor Ian. But like, that was such a huge, if you get written out of the show, you're dying out of the show, it's such a huge career. It's such a huge impact to your career. I just thought it was interesting that was like, a ritual that if you got that phone call from the Double D's, you knew what was coming because they don't just call you out of the blue to discuss your hairstyle, your costuming or whatever.
Yeah, I know. It is kind of funny. It's funny to think of obviously how close everyone on this crew must have been. But the fact that Benioff and Weiss like withheld like direct contact with the actors unless it was the sorry you're dead and out of a job call is kind of funny to me. I also loved like Natalie Dormer was one of my favorite anecdotes in there because she actually contacted them to be like, hey, like I have this other job that I might be getting and I wanted to talk about like the schedule and of shooting and everything, and they were like, oh yeah, you're dying, don't worry about it. That's fine. You're fine. You can take that job or whatever. And then like inversely, reading so many of those anecdotes and then hearing that like they didn't have a conversation with Amelia Clark ahead of time and like just kind of like sent the scripts off and like let her absorb what happened was really kind of surprising to me, because you can tell in interviews and stuff that she was so affected by how Danny's story ended.
Well, like there's the famous story of Kit Harington, like at the table read. Like, in fact, we saw that recording of like him not knowing and getting to that and just like, oh my God, it's a moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting that by the time the final season rolled around, they're like, okay, you're all just going to get the news at the same time via these scripts, which makes sense. But I think for a character as big as Daenerys, and I think given again, like, so many people took issue with how quickly that happened to her. Mm-hmm. And I think if they had made an exception and told her like a season early and been like, hey, like, this is where you're headed and we need you to start like
thinking slowly about that. Yeah.
Yeah, just weaving it up maybe into the background of her performance a little bit. Not in an obvious way, but just like I think that the fact that shocked her so much kind of reverberated through fans being also really unsettled with how quickly
looked at the dragon mom, and if mom's scared, then the kids are too. It's like, and there's a lot of like interviews where you can tell there's like a tightness around the eyes, and they're like, best season ever. Who do you think took it the worst?
They're the news?
Yeah.
Oh, Lordy. That's a good question. I don't know. The funniest one to me was when they tried to prank Alfie Allen and be like, oh, we're killing you, and he just like didn't care.
Cool.
That was more amusing to me. He was like on vacation and they were like, hey, did you get the scripts? And he's like, yeah, whatever. Like, I'm leaving this show. I think Michelle Fairley and Richard Madden talking about the Red Wedding was really that I really love that story, because you can tell that they were so close. And that having to film the deaths of their characters was really, it really took a toll on them emotionally, because they felt that loss in the same way that I think the rest of us were feeling it.
You also have a chapter around the same spot where you talk about the pranks, that like this was like a top down prank production, that the Double D's got into, you know, pranking the actors, and the actors got into it. What do you think the funniest prank that was played on someone was?
I do really love Hannah Murray and Kit Harington like ganging up on John Bradley West, who played Sam, with like his costume prank. Just because that, like, you know, you can tell how close all these folks got over the years. And I don't, like, Kit Harington is always so serious. Like, he's obviously very serious on the show as John, but like the idea of him like conspiring with Hannah Murray to be like, oh my God, we're going to tell him like this thing. And so, yeah, so they made him, they were the ones who got David and Dan to pretend like they were giving him this like God awful costume.
Cause he had been stuck in like essentially Maester's dark black brother robes the whole time. And then it's like, oh, you're going to get a new costume cause you're getting out of this whole thing.
Right. And at the same time that Kit Harington is like getting this like glorious, you know, Stark cape and like this whole
King of the North. Yeah.
Yeah. Like freaking John Bradley thinks that he's like, it's called a codpiece. It's like literally this like big kind of like jester's looking like medieval outfit with like a huge, it's like a jock strap, but like one that's like dazzled to like look like, I don't know, your dick covering it.
They described it like what was like some kind of nightmare Henry the Eighth kind of thing. Because if you look at like a lot of the Game of Thrones covers before it got released as an HBO series, like they hired some fantasy author, and he is always illustrating it in that kind of style, where the big puffy sleeves with the stripes and the weird hats with the big plumes coming out of it. And it's very, it's very kind of Shakespeare production instead of like, you know, grim medieval realism kind of direction. And it reminded me of that he's, and it's all like Pepto-Bismol pink. And just the other thing is, the funniest thing is that like John's just a good sport about it. He's like, well, I guess this is my new costume, you know?
Yeah. He wasn't like immediately like, there's no way. He was like, okay. Like, yeah, he was a total pro. But I love that Hannah Murray was like, I could tell that he was upset, but he just wasn't saying anything.
It's not a prima donna. What's the most surprising thing you learned in researching the book?
Oh, that's a great question. My inner capacity for stress. It's hard to pick just one thing, but I think in general, all of that early season one information, and like again back to like the pilot and like interviews around that time, because I wasn't covering the show professionally until season five, and so I was always just watching it as a fan, and I wasn't someone who went and read like every single postmortem interview with an actor or all of that jazz. I was just basically on like the subreddits, and so anything that was picked up from the A Song of Ice and Fire subreddit folks, I would know. Mm-hmm. But it was, for me, it was a lot of fun, like going back and reading, like the director who did that initial pilot, Tom McCarthy, mm-hmm. right? I'm like, I need to read my own book because it's been a minute. But yeah, like the original director kind of had this very, very frank interview that he gave back in 2011, just being like, no, like, he basically said that when he makes something, he likes to feel like he has some sort of an input and that he's helping sort of craft the look and the feel right. of it. And that just wasn't the deal with that pilot. Like he wasn't the person who was kind of like making calls. It was really Benioff and Weiss's vision. And he just was there to execute it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting, and that was, you know, kind of part of what played a role in him not returning to film the actual final version. So yeah, that was really interesting to me. Cause again, it speaks to all of these little things that were there from the inception of the show, all kind of explain what happened 10 years later when they were filming the final season. But it's just, you know, people weren't paying as close attention back then because they didn't have 20 million people watching every Sunday night. They like barely had 2, and those 2 million people weren't like, oh my God, this is the biggest show I've ever seen. It was just right. like another new show back then. So I think all of that revisitation of people talking about those early seasons is really fascinating to me.
So what do you think about the prospects of Game of Thrones, like the property moving forward? You know, there's at least one prequel. I think there's actually 2 being greenlit and worked on by HBO. Of course, Martin could always at some time, I don't know, finish Winds of Winter. There's also Fire and Blood Volume 2 coming out. Something I'm always asking myself as a person who covers, you know, makes part of my livelihood, no small part of my livelihood, and covering Game of Thrones. What is your feeling that the fans, as soon as there's a new property out, are going to be ready for it, are going to be eagerly anticipating it? What's your read on that?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be the same number of people. I think that there would have been a drop off anyways from the finale of Game of Thrones to whatever the next prequel is, and we'll see. They've definitely greenlit 2 pilots. We don't have a whole series that right. we know for sure right. is coming out yet. So yeah, I think there was always going to be a drop off. I think that drop off is going to be a little more stark than it may be.
Hardy hard.
did not mean to do that. I'm so sorry. but yeah, I think it's going to be more drastic than it would have been had they like fully stuck the landing and had 100% approval on the decisions that they made there. My like optimistic hope is that it turns into like a Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul situation where it's a much smaller audience, but it's like a very beloved and like critically acclaimed spinoff prequel thing that they managed to pull off.
That's a good, cause like, that's the thing is like Better Call Saul doesn't try to be Breaking Bad. Like right. it's got a slower pace. It's more deliberate. It's, you know, not quite as kinetic, but they really go for broke on the, you know, character development and the right. interpersonal relationships.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest hope, and I mean, we know that they were working on these pilot scripts before the final season came out, but my hope is that a lesson is taken from the way that people received the final season, and that whoever's working on these shows understands that the reason why they were so beloved had, sure, it had something to do with that epic high fantasy aspect of it, but it really boiled down to this like incredible set of characters and the way that those characters were developed over a long period of time. So I think either something, yeah, like I said, more Better Call Saul situation, or like a more limited series type of thing, you know, where we don't necessarily go into it expecting to get 73 hours of the next story, but maybe it's just like an 8 or 10 episode thing. And sure, there's some epic battles and whatever thrown in there, but really what it does is kind of just expand the world and give us maybe some answers to questions that we didn't know we had, or that we already do have about this world. And yeah, that's my best hope for it. But it's really, I no longer feel like I can confidently say like, oh yeah, it's going to be awesome and huge and I can't wait. I'm very, there's a lot of trepidation now, I think, around it. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's how most Game of Thrones fans feel, unfortunately.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. I think The Unofficial Guide to Game of Thrones is a must read if you're a fan of Game of Thrones. And there's a lot, like, other than just the behind the scenes, information we've talked about, there's just tons of stuff about like fan reactions and kind of covering like big events, like, you know, everybody's preoccupation with the Red Wedding and filming people's reactions to it and stuff like that. There's a lot of like reading through it is very nostalgic and like a fan archaeologist, like, oh, digging through all the layers of like, oh, right, this is when this was a moment. This was this a moment. It's a real nostalgic, fun read. It's an easy read. I recommend it to everybody. Kim, where do you find this book if you want, if you're of the mind to purchase it?
Well, first, thank you so much. That's so lovely of you to say. Yeah, you can find it. There's like a Simon & Schuster landing page, which has links to everything. So if you look up like Kim Renfro, Guide to Game of Thrones, you can buy it on Amazon. You can go to any local bookstore, call them, and they'll be able to order it for you. Barnes & Noble. There's an audiobook on Audible, which is pretty cool. And you can very even buy cool. it on like CD, which, hey, that would be pretty crazy if my book's like on compact disc in someone's living room. So yeah, all those places. And if you find me, I'm on Twitter at Kim R. Renfro. And my like pinned tweet, I think right now, is just like an easy link. So yeah, you can find it there.
And for everyone listening's convenience, I will have links to all that in the show notes. Kim, again, thanks for coming on. It's always a pleasure to have you, and can't wait to collaborate with you again.
Yeah, thank you so much.